At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
At the UPS store, we know being a small business owner means holiday time is still go time. Still get those orders shipped time. And still re-up on stamps and supplies time. That's why this upcoming holiday, while others close up shop, we'll be open. And happy to help you keep being unstoppable. Come into your local store today. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. The UPS store. Be unstoppable.
Welcome back to the Beyond Broadcast podcast, a show which takes a behind-the-scenes look at industry professionals and their lives working in the broadcasting and entertainment industry. Today, I'm speaking with what I'm assuming is Wellington-born and Christchurch-based former journalist and musician Daryl Baser. Daryl has never been one to limit himself to solely one field and never seems to stay in more than one place for too long, and it's very evident by the fact that today we're actually speaking to him while he's in the car. Having moved around the country to various places, he's dipped into being a music writer, senior reporter, he's had a bit of politics as well, and was more recently a broadcast news producer for the Otago Daily Times. Welcome to the show, Daryl. How have you found Christchurch thus far? For the 3 years? Because, so I didn't realise you were such a recent arrival. I thought you'd been there for a number of years now.
No, I am. While in Dunedin, I met an amazing Cantabrian, after all things being even, we decided that my move north was more productive than her move south. I moved up here and haven't looked back. And speaking of not looking back, GPS has been my absolute friend.
I think that's the weird thing with Christchurch. Despite being a bit of a grid city, it does feel fairly easy to get lost. I say the same about Dunedin and Wellington. Every time I've gone back to Wellington or Dunedin at any point, I find it impossible to navigate. So I would have assumed Christchurch was the easy one. So that's good to know that it's not just a me problem.
No, heck no. I found Dunedin easy. I was there for 28 years. As long as there's a hill next to you or behind you, the sea's going to be somewhere there on the other side, if that makes sense. So it's like similar with Wellington.
Exactly.
If you're in the hills, look
down.
Yeah,
classic navigation rule.
Yeah. Whereas Christchurch, it's big, it's flat, and the roads change names. Well, it looks like a straight road on GPS.
That's a good point. That's a valid point. Even on the same road, it changes name.
Yeah.
No, very valid point. I never thought of that. And I guess a good starting point for that, I guess, Daryl, talking about travelling and everything else, is despite being born in the windy city of Wellington, it seems like a lot of your younger years were actually spent in Gisborne, and it seems you're always kind of meant to go on that sort of traveller's journey. So as a child, were you always kind of out and about in the camper van with the family, or was this kind of like a thing that developed later in life that you were travelling around the country?
Definitely later. I was in Wellington for the first 4 years of life. My dad got, I was made in England but born here, so I was the bump. Dad got poached. He was working as a lead type compositor for the Dorset Evening Echo in the UK, and then they sent recruiters around and stuff. And the recruiter said, "Oh, do you want to come and work for the Dom in New Zealand?" And he's like, "New Zealand, eh?" So they packed up the whānau So first 4 years he was at the Dom post, the Dominion back then, and I was at daycare, and then we moved to Gisborne, when I was four and a half, five. So I did all my schooling in Gisborne, and I spent many weekends running around the Gisborne Herald when Dad was working weekend shifts. Mum would take the family in, and we were playing on my cars in the editor's office. It's kind of cool. I've always been around journalism. I loved walking past the reporter's room in the 70s and Gisborne. Fugs of smoke coming pouring out of it. It was always great. Now, the Gillies family, Amanda's dad was the editor. At one point, there was like four Gillieses working for the Gisborne Herald, and and three Bazers. We were taking them on. Didn't quite make it, though.
So the Bazer dynasty took over news and entertainment on every respect, and I guess in that way it made sense you were always going to go into that space, especially towards the sort of technical side of things, because you've kind of always been a bit more on the camera side, more so than the producing side, I guess. And do you remember what your first stage production was that you worked on for Lytton High School? Because you obviously saw the newsroom, but then you took it upon yourself to get involved in the production side of things at a very early age.
Yeah, I quite, you've done some research, well done. So unlike me. who, what, why, where, when, how? Yeah, I worked on a couple of productions in fourth and fifth form. I did Star Blaze. I was on stage for, and it was kind of fun. It was a singing and dancing thing, and it was as an overweight kid with major body image issues and classic teenage hang-ups of thinking no one liked me. It took a lot to actually get me on stage. When I got there, I was with a group of other friends on stage. It was like, this is actually really quite cool. I quite like this. And then I hooked up with, it was Unity Theatre in Gisborne, and started doing sound work for them as well. I did a couple of productions for them, and one of them was basically recording sound effects for a show that was about cricket. So I had to record cricket sound effects, including people going, "How's that?" and all that sort of stuff. And the sound of, you know, bat on ball, and then cue them up on, record them on cassette tape and cue them up at the right time, that sort of thing. That's quite fun.
Before we go to the next question, I wanted to also touch on something, because that was when you started dipping into audio as well, and part of your background has always been music to some degree. And if you were going to take me back to Gisborne in the 90s, and I was going to be going to see a gig, maybe at the local show, like event house, I don't know, what would you call them now? Local gig spot, the local hole, the local cave? Which band would I be seeing in the 90s in Gisborne? What would be the most recognisable name I'd be seeing in the 90s Gisborne indie music scene? And Daryl would probably be right at the front. Who would I be going to watch?
Good grief. I only played a couple of shows in a band that was like a first band thing. I think the band's name was Playground Twist, which is a reference to Susie and the Banshees, being a young goth at the time, said with massive eye roll. One of the biggest names that was playing at the time around was a band called Tomokai, a reggae band. We opened up some, you know, four or five, four or five disaffected white kids playing, opening up this gorgeous, fully Polynesian reggae band, who are just tight as, phenomenal. That was the Record Rain. The River Arena. No, that was Hamilton. For the life of me, I can't remember the name. It wasn't Record Rain. That was the only Black Power pub in a Mugga Mob town. So no one who went there. It was a tough call. Wear red or wear blue, for God's sake, don't get it wrong.
And Daryl, fast forwarding a bit, because we were talking about your time in the lovely Gisborne, and you moved at some point to Dunedin, where you began writing about the music scene for the Allied Press. And it was during the 90s. Must have been a bit of a strange time for you, because there was a lot of alternative music coming out of the city. There was a huge wave from the Flying Nun crew. You had the jangle pop and everything else in between. During the 80s, how did you find it going to Dunedin after that kind of big wave? But what trends did you kind of see emerge from that sort of new era after the Flying Nun sort of explosion that occurred?
It was interesting. I got there and I got to Dunedin in 93, and I'd lived in Hamilton for a couple of years. Don't do that again. No offense, Hamilton, but I didn't enjoy you. We're in Margaret City. I liked more than Kiss Country and Western. And I didn't like when there was, remember the first Pride rally in Hamilton? And all the little flyers that stuck to the ones, the pro Pride flyers that weren't ripped down had charming things like fucking unnatural bastards written on them. So thanks, Hamilton. But I digress. So got to Dunedin. I was grieving the suicide of my father. I was not happy. And during Hamilton, I put on, 30 kilograms. I was about 105 kgs, 110 on a bad day, and was smoking too much cannabis, drinking too much alcohol, eating crap. And my sister was living in Karatane, just out of Dunedin. She said, bro, you're not well. I can tell you're not well. I had pleurisy as well, which is, go that. You know you're unhealthy when you give yourself a lung infection. So I moved down and I'd been a songwriter for a few years by then. And I thought, I'll give it a crack. Right, I'm in Dunedin. The phone will start ringing. No one knows who you are. You're a complete nobody. Started organizing gigs. So I started, going to lots of shows and met other people who were making music and got a couple of small bands and stuff and just started organizing gigs. And then I noticed there was a bit of a gap in the amount of people who were writing about music as well. So I started doing CD reviews for Critic in 90, that student magazine down there, in, say, 94. And then I was a music editor at Critic in 95. Seeing lots of shows, that sort of stuff. And then late 96, a lady called Angela Crompton, who was a music writer at ODT, said, hey, I'm watching you develop as a writer. Want to write a local music column for the ODT? And so I pitched the idea and went to the editor and they said no. And then Angela basically put a good word in for me and then they said yes.
It's kind of interesting that you pivoted from going into music like straight after what would be probably one of the most traumatic things that's happened in your life. Do you feel that music kind of became that community that you needed at that time, that support kind of that you needed, just based on the fact that it was a creative outlet for you to kind of express your thoughts, but also be around other people that maybe had other things going on in their lives as well? Is that kind of what you found in Dunedin?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I released a cassette in 95 that I pretentiously called Subliminal Reactive Catharsis, which kind of described how I wrote songs. For a person who never learnt well at school, I'm never sure whether I was on the spectrum or dyslexic or whatever. As I said, my wife's a specialist educator, and she took one look at my handwriting and said, you're dysgraphic, which is a nice way of saying you write like a doctor. You're like a drunken spider tap dancing. I never learned well. But I've always liked words, always liked language. And I've always found language is a good vehicle for expression. And songwriting, I've always I grew up listening to my dad's Beatles and Bo Diddley and stuff like that. And, I've always loved rhythm and melody. And I always felt better with music. So it was part, a lot of it was therapy, was self-therapy. Having done a decade of therapy in the mid-90s through to the mid-2000s. Music has always been an outlet and always, and there were lots of like-minded people down here who are, in Dunedin, who were, writing and stuff. And there's so many people who are writing and they were writing fun stuff. And it's like, wow, you can write music that's about fun. I didn't understand that. I thought music being an expression had to be a real downer.
Goth Daryl was almost like looking at all these happy, jangly Dunedin musicians being like, what have you got so much to be chuffed about? Everything's miserable and we're in this cold city that is Dunedin. Yeah. Why are you so happy? Was it kind of like you opened a new door for you and like Angela was almost the one that opened that door for you to be like, Daryl, seriously, you got to check this stuff out. Like, there's a lot more going on here.
Very, very much so. Yeah, and getting me into the ODT as a music writer was really cool. And from that, I did that for a number of, like, I think 2012 when I stopped the music column. But during that time, the ODT needed an editorial assistant to work at the right hand of the chief reporter. First person to take phone calls to the news floor, that sort of thing. So you have to, you're the first filter between, is this an actual story or just angry man shouts at clouds or someone who's, you know, mentally unwell, to put it in polite terms. But because it is, and you get a lot of that in newsrooms. People are, you know, ring up ranting and raving and stuff. And you know there's, you know, it's not a damn thing you can do to help them. But, unless you've got mental health experience, you can then, if you've got time, you find out who their PDN is and get them to reach out and say, bro, here is...
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Very well. But that's, you know, that's not part of the job. That's part of being a human, I suppose.
Did you have any repeat offenders that were regularly calling into the ODT that you got to know them on a first name basis? Because I certainly know from myself working in radio, at a local radio that is, I used to get like the odd caller that would call me every weekend. There was one particular one, which was an old man that would complain if I got the weather wrong when I was doing a weather reading. Like, I've just checked Met Service and you're 1 degree off. And I checked at 10:02. And I was like, oh, sorry, Gary. Like, I did this recording, this pre-record at 10:01. He's like, well, you're inaccurate. You're meant to be accurate. So did you have anything like that, like with the ODT, like a regular caller in?
Regular callers who were a bit nuts and had access to grind. But the favourite regular caller was, I think, Richard. Channel 9, the local telly, had worked for a number of years. Channel 9 played, during filler times, a lot of train stuff. And Richard was an absolute train spotter. Like, he even came into the studio a couple of times and bought the DVD copies that we made of this New Zealand Railways and British Railways and stuff. They were just CDs we'd got given from other train spotters, or DVDs, sorry, we'd got given, and we broadcast them. And if you played them out of order, he would ring up and say, you've played number 2, and you should be playing number 1 this week. It's like, but bro, how many times have you seen these? It was gold. Harmless, but gold. Absolutely just, you know, this was his world. Us, Channel 9, playing the trains. I hate to know what he's doing now, because Channel 9 closed down a few years ago, and there's now still Southern Productions. Luke Chapman's still doing video content down there, which is nice. But, the videography isn't what it used to be. Oh, the ODT's news gathering videography isn't what it used to be.
And I guess that's maybe a thing that a lot of people don't realise is, and it's kind of the sad thing that you see with syndication in a lot of areas, especially with news and television and radio and everything else, is that local connection's kind of missing. And for a lot of people, that is their kind of connection to the community, is being in contact with their local news station or being in contact with their local TV channel. Do you think that's something that might have a resurgence at some point, that people are going to realise that having a local produced news show or local produced television station does still have value even in this time?
It does. Like, I am absolutely biased because it was my lifeblood. For the first period was 5 years, the second period was 5.5-6 years, and as someone who became a recognized face in Dunedin, which sounds really strange, but, you know, small pond, big fish, it's regional TV is missing, and there is a gap for it, a massive gap that can't be filled with newspapers. I think the press is doing a pretty good job with regional stories here, the local stories. I honestly can't say the same about the Star. I did a short period up here before I went to Dangerous Goods Management at the Star, and trying to pitch, I didn't find it an environment conducive to actual local stories. That's about as politically nicely as I can put it. There were many stories I pitched about the community I lived in. I only got a couple across the line. I pitched dozens and dozens to the point where I just gave up pitching.
What do you think that is, that those didn't make it across the line? Do you feel that too many publications are now dipping into sensationalism and want something that's a bit more extreme? Or is the classic thing sad, depressing, and dreary? We don't want anything that's positive, happy, or anything that kind of reflects the community in a way that might make it look nicer than what it is. Because I certainly know from me reading headlines and some of the local papers, and I won't name any specifically, but it does seem like news for the most part now is just has to be depressing, has to be about crime, has to be about something where there's blood or drama or something of the sort, and nothing that's actually... And that's not to say those stories aren't of substance, but it doesn't seem like there's ever anything positive happening in the news. It's almost like they're searching for it when sometimes it's not even there.
Yeah, exactly. You're exactly correct. The old expression, if it bleeds, it leads, is in my head. Mm. It's true. I remember, you know, filming, going to accidents and stuff, and God, I remember crossing the line, getting told off my first year. A cyclist had been run over by a truck, and I filmed blood coming out from underneath the canvas, where his body was taped off, closed off, and yeah, got my hand quite severely slapped by that, because, you know, the boss, and it was Luke, said that was someone's relative. And you've crossed the line. Don't do that again. And so, you know, it seems you learn on the job. And I've ever met their family. I apologize for doing that because, you know, I realized I crossed the line. There are community stories out there that, that are valuable and need to be told and just won't be told. Like, you see them in school newsletters all the time. My stepson's at Richton High. And in the newsletter, you see... I can't think of the wee person's name, who had just been representing the countries in sport, like volleyball, at 16, 17 years old. And these stories are missed. They and it's, you know, little Johnny or little Jane going above and beyond. Or things like karate schools where children have come from indifferent backgrounds, and they've been troublemakers at school, and they're finding themselves and finding focus through learning a martial art. And you'd never get a story like that across the line. Yet all the people who go to that school, or that sort of thing, they would read it. They would show it to their friends. So those are more and more eyes for advertisers to exploit. And so I don't get the current sensationalistic rubbish. It's the same thing, I think, it's my humble opinion, is why politicians just yell crap at each other across the house instead of seeming to work on policy. Because that sort of, you know, automatic naysaying and, you know, playing the man not the ball or the person not the ball, is the way in celebrity politics. Like, Winston's war on woke. I know that I shouldn't get too political, but I think him and Shane Jones are just echoing the Trump playbook for popularity, and it's divisive and it's dangerous. And what does woke mean anyway? It means having empathy, kindness, and compassion. Let's have a war on that. Seriously, you know.
Touching on something that I feel maybe is another aspect of even the media industry in New Zealand, as well as also the political sphere, do you feel like we're too much trying to mimic outside influences like the US and the UK in terms of what we're producing locally, when in reality New Zealand is a completely different beast?
Yeah. You're right. Coming up next on Fox News. Yeah, it's like, come on. We don't need to do that. We don't need to dumb it down. One of the most... saddest stories I ever did was going to Natural History New Zealand in Dunedin, when it was just bought by the American company I was bought by. I can't remember who it was. NHNZ, great documentaries, absolutely the pinnacle of documentary making, world famous. And then I talked to the new CEO down there, and she said, we don't do documentaries anymore. We do fact-based entertainment. So you're making bullshit sound good then. Great. Well done, you. I'm just waiting for the day that a news helicopter follows a car chase like O.J. Simpson. And, you know, a car that was stolen in Rimuera is all the way to Otara. Yeah. We're following with a tracking cam. It's like, you know, and that bullshit's going to happen. And it's just wrong. I would have liked to have thought we're better than that. But we're dumbing stuff down. And it seems to be following the American dumbed-down model. Like the breakthroughs in American TV, you know, when they come back from the break, you've just learned that Johnny and Jane are doing this. So Johnny and Jane are doing this, and this is what Johnny and Jane are doing. Good, I know that. I'm not a simpleton, you know?
Yeah, it takes another 3 minutes to recap, and then you go to the next ad break before the recap's even finished.
So this is the role of journalism. Tell them what you're telling them that you told them. It's great. It's good. But not every 15 seconds at the detriment of actual content and actual fact.
I think it does get to a point where it's so rehashed that it loses any point. Mm. And as you coordinated a small news team yourself, do you feel like you tried to take that sort of approach in terms of how you were building stories? Because I saw that you were a senior leader at one point within the ODT. You were leading a news team and helping produce content. Were you very specific about how that content was produced? And did you try to make sure that it kind of fitted within the sort of framework that you ideally wanted to see happen, which is informative, obviously has some sort of impact, but isn't necessarily just a headline grab?
I tried to. I look back and I think how much younger I was then and how I do it differently now. I always, I've never been a natural leader. It's never been my thing. I've never really wanted to stand up and say, hey, look at me. Like, I nearly failed my broadcasting diploma because my piece to camera is 6 seconds long and they said it was too short because I was just so unconfident about, you know, being on camera and speaking. And I never thought I had anything worthwhile to say. But then becoming a broadcast journalist, you are the news conduit. You have got something to say and you need to be able to put these facts across in a concise manner and accurately report what Jane says and what John says. And it's with fair, you know, fair and accurate and balanced reporting. That was always the bar I set, the bar I wanted to have. But I was never a strong leader. I look back now, and I never like looking back and regretting, but there are things I would have done better. I would have actually led. If I had personality conflicts in a newsroom, I would have actually taken both parties aside and said, look, I can tell you two don't like each other. That's fine. But you will be human and you'll respect each other and you'll work together. I didn't do any of that. I let stuff boil over. You know, managerial stuff, I had no idea what I was doing. And that's, you always look back and think there's things I can do better. But I always wanted people to tell the stories and get people on camera who knew their own stories, who weren't the limelight grabbers. Like, there are always people around who are very good at working the media and very good at getting on camera and on radio and getting to provide sound bites. But there are so many other human beings who have good stories to tell. Now, I think TVNZ's good sort scratches at that quite well. It could be done. I think it could be done bigger than the entire series. 24-minute, 30-piece of TV each week would be kind of cool. But that's way too down home. That's way too humble. That's way too small. And I don't think people would ever see the value in that, which I find really sad. Because there are characters in every city, and not many of them actually hold the limelight. But if you can find those people and get them comfortable enough to tell their story, for me that's gold. That's actual journalism. Finding the stories that aren't being told.
So that you're the second person that has mentioned this, whether it be on mic or off mic, particularly good sorts, and saying that's the sort of content people should be producing, and I completely agree. And yeah, it's a shame. It's never going to be popular because people aren't going to think that this is something that sells, which is weird because it's positive. People like hearing positive stories. They don't want drab and dreary all the time. I know it's probably what gets the clicks, but sadly it's the attention grab. But I think for the betterment of people, I think they would much prefer saying things like Good Sorts, which, yeah, for anyone who's an international listener, it's a feature that's been run on Believe One News, and usually the late night current affairs shows in New Zealand, which focuses on someone who's doing something good in the community, whether it be charity work or something that's of like some value to the community in general, or something that's just interesting that someone's doing at a small scale in New Zealand. And Daryl's completely right. It's this weird little slice of happiness and joy, I guess, for a lot of people amongst all the crap that's hanging about usually in the general news cycle. And it's kind of good that we're moving into this area, because the thing is that you moved back into producing content for various news outlets, but before that, you pivot into politics, which is usually not something a lot of people do when they work in journalism, because usually they see the sometimes difficult world that is working in the political sphere. So what made you, Daryl, decide, I'm going to dip into politics and see what happens? What was the kicker for you? What kind of made it so that you were like, I need to give this a go?
There's a myriad of reasons. One, I had a very young family at the time, and my partner at the time wasn't coping very well with young children. And so I was working, Channel 9 was a 45, 50 hour week, 40 which paid. And it was always, you're always on game. You're always, like being any journalist, you never actually stop. And so when you've got 18 months old and a newborn on the way, or either a newborn, or, you know, I'm not quite sure how old my youngest was back then, but yeah, when you've got that sort of stuff, you can't, and the person who's not coping, you need to step up. So I needed to reduce hours, but I need to get paid the same. And so I'd already done, Dr. David Clark was just stepping into the role for Pete Hodgson. One of the last stories I did with him was him and Pete handing over to Dave. And these are, for your initial listeners, these are MPs in Dunedin North Electorate, which is now just the Dunedin Electorate in southern New Zealand. Pete Hodgson was a mainstay of politics in New Zealand for many, many years. Wise old man. Probably smack me in the head for calling him old, but, you know. A wise head. He's never danced on camera. Never search YouTube Pete Hodgson dancing. It's not very good. Well, actually, it's embarrassing as hell. But yeah, so Pete was handing over to Dave, giving his nod. And I watched Pete schooling David on how to stand to camera and how, you know, to feet plant, shoulders apart, slight shoulder turn. Look, you know, don't look down the barrel unless you're told to. Look at the reporter across camera. And it was beautiful, like the Jedi schooling the Padawan. And David Clark was just taking it all in. And so I actually filmed the cutaways of them doing that. It was like, cool. But yeah, and then the job came up in David's office, an issues assistant, 25, 30 hours a week. And so I met up and had a chat and went through the process. And working 30 hours a week, which is better for home life. And I was getting paid more for 30 hours a week working for parliamentary services than I was for Channel 9 regional TV. So regional TV is the thing you do for passion, because there's no money in it, which is a real shame. I think there should be, but that's just me. And then I discovered my skin wasn't thick enough for politics. I naively thought, and this should get a laugh, it usually does, that politics would be more straightforward than journalism in a newsroom.
You took the peek behind the proverbial curtain and found that it was a lot more hectic than you probably imagined. And what were the more unique challenges you found from that role in politics? Because anyone who knows anything about a newsroom is that can be hectic as hell. Things can change at the blink of an eye. What do you think were the major differences that you didn't see at the time, and now looking back, you're like, man, that was bloody hard working in that office.
Gosh, working where everyone's got clear and obvious agendas, their own agendas, which they won't tell you about. You've got to guess at. And if you cross someone's agenda and push someone else's agenda, you get in trouble. If you're not perfectly on message, you're in trouble. I loved working with David, and David's a good human being, very good human being. But I think the shock of having stuff in my personal life going on as well, and the shock of the duplicity within the wider party. And there were people who were in the party back then who were kind and nice and empathic and good humans. And there were sharks around them who would. And the sharks started winning. And I didn't like that. And in a party, like, I've never really been that political, but I've always leaned towards left. But yeah, so the wider party, the sharks are starting to win. And it's not how I saw Labour. And I saw the, it started going to the right wing and the more duplicitous and the more, I arrange visits for the MPs. So you have the spokesperson for X, Y, and Z come down and you go and do chats with other people. And one of the people I invited down, we got him down, got him a lot of speaking stuff and engagements. And that was really cool. I love the whole networking, you know, vibe. And I found out later the only reason that person came down was to secure David and Claire's votes to roll the leader. He didn't give shit one about seeing the people who's seeing. He was doodling while he was in these meetings, and did not care. He just wanted to get their votes. That's the only reason he came down.
In that same respect, that it is important to have news that is reflective of the local community, particularly in politics, because I think I've noticed more recently, especially in the press, because you mentioned the press is quite good with this, and I completely agree that the press is very forward in terms of even mentioning things like council meetings and aggressively pushing into, like, actually looking into issues that are affecting local communities. I actually saw, for once, a positive story about the council, which was about, because you guys are experiencing floods at the moment in Christchurch. We're recording this in May, and they spoke about the renovational works that they've done throughout the city to stop it from flooding everywhere. And it's the first time I've ever seen a positive council story. Usually it's bagging on the council, how terrible they are. They never do anything. And I was like, wow, this is awesome. And it does the having that viewpoint of seeing, as you said, this politician literally coming down to schmooze and ultimately at the end of the day influence other people to make votes that was probably maybe to the detriment of the party. Does that make you even more have faith in the fact that there is a very big need for journalism, particularly local journalism?
Absolutely. It reminds me of the need for a fair and balanced and completely separate fourth estate, and we need it now more than ever. I can't believe, yes, you are correct, that did open my eyes to that absolute need for scrutiny. And fair, not attack scrutiny on people, on particular people, but scrutiny of political ideals and scrutiny of, are they going the right way doing this? And so you find academic A and academic B to say, I think it's this and I think it's that. You get some balance in the middle. But yeah, like recently, I don't know how the journalists were following Winston Peters. I'm having a name, I don't really care. They led him away with not answering questions and the bluster and the BS he throws at them. I don't know how anyone, it's actually a thing my wife has said to me, she's politically astute and I'm a lucky man. She says, why the hell don't the journalists actually say, no, mate, I'm a taxpayer, I pay your wages, you'll answer my bloody questions, thanks. Simple as that. Why? Because they are elected, we pay exorbitant amounts for their wages. Party leaders, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And then, of course, there's the perks and the BS on top of that. And it's so they should be more accountable than they are. And that's regardless of left or right. They should all be accountable for the money they spend. And not just shuffling deck chairs like Minister Stanford's latest slip. She's going to get rid of at the budget a specialist education program, which sees, I think it's specialist education. It's a program which sees schools cluster, and a school with more experience in some areas will be like a kaitiaki or guardian of other schools. And so the schools are helping each other out, which is cool. But apparently it's quite a costly scheme, so they're going to axe that. They got leaked out of Erica Stanford's office this morning, which is May 6th, NZ time. And John Gerritsen at RNZ got hold of it. And but during his article, in his article, he used the word, he said the money's going to go to working with disabled learners, which I kind of think the 1950s wants its syntax back. You know, that is to say someone's disabled is a stigmatization these days. It's, you have all high and complex learning needs, and to label someone as disabled, I got it at school. I wasn't a good learner. I was put in slow classes and stuff. That sort of shit leaves marks. It makes, you know, you either crumble or you get tough, and you get angry, and that makes you get stuff to work for you. That's a real time. You get bloody minded and determined to not give in, to not quit.
And that has that always kind of transpired for you in everything in life, because you had those difficulties at high school, that it's kind of meant that you've had this sort of way about you, that you're always aggressively going to push for whatever you're wanting to do in life?
Not aggressively, because that's kind of a bit bad. When I was younger, I was a very angry person. To the detriment of people around me, to the point where I sought help, went to anger management, stopping violence programs, and then became a White Ribbon ambassador. When I turned around, I got phoned by the head of White Ribbon and said, "Hey, I've watched your story. I know you. Do you want to step up and become an ambassador?" And I cried. I kept it to myself for 6 months. Didn't tell a single soul. And then I mentioned it and said, "Hey, I've been asked to do this. Do you think I'm good enough?" And the person I was with said, "Yes, you should." So it was a complete aside. Studying for broadcast journalism was the one of the toughest years of my life. Actually having to, you know, read text on a page and have it make sense, and then be able to send that text back. And which sounds, you know, as a journalist, that sounds, you know, well, you do it every day. But having the static out of the back of your head that's saying, "You don't know what you're doing. You can't do this." All that sort of BS, you know, you're a charlatan, you're a fraud. Having that negative, getting that to bugger off so you can focus on what you're doing was cool. And it's, So yes, it made me crusade for always champion underdogs. I felt like an underdog. I've always wanted to champion other people I perceive as underdogs.
It kind of makes me want to rewind on something else that you touched on, which was RNZ, Radio New Zealand, which in a sense is kind of the underdog in media, very much trying to be unbiased as much as they can, and especially now, probably losing more funding than they probably ever had before, along with a lot of other public broadcasting outfits. Do you feel like there hasn't been enough emphasis put on public broadcasting in general from governments, especially now? Or do you feel like it's a dying sort of form? We shouldn't really be putting much into it, because the reality is people aren't paying attention to it. What's your opinion on it?
I've been, like, when we started the interview, I had to turn RNZ off in the car. I know the right wing see it as, they call it red radio. A guy I worked with in Dunedin, who's entwined with ACT, refers to it as red radio. And so it's accused of having the pro Labor bias. I don't believe it. I've seen him take Labor MPs to task. But I think we do need it. It is necessary, very, very necessary. Now more than ever. It's kind of an underdog in some ways. But I don't think it's dying out. It shouldn't die out. Radio, there are still old guys like me who listen to car radios. I even got a CD player I sing along to at times. I think where they're going multimedia and hosting some stuff in studio, and so they've got a broadcast arm as well, and now the writing and also copy sharing as well. They're doing with, I know RNT copy shares with ODT, NZ Herald. There's so much of it going on now. That it's kind of, I think RNZ is cementing its place. It does need the funding it's getting. I remember, you know, working for RNZ, the wage was a professional journalist wage, unlike others I've been given. But no one's mentioned that at all. But it was, I remember getting the first, being asked, "This is your hourly rate. Are you okay with that?" And I remember trying to make my face mask into, out of, you know, "My God, that much?" And I'm trying to retain my, retain that. Woohoo! But, And yes, that'll be adequate, thanks.
Yeah, I can live on that. And in that respect as well, because the other underdog, which you seem to have quite a bit of involvement with, and I only base this off the fact that I saw a couple of photos of you on Facebook around the Dunedin campus. Did you have some involvement with the student radio scene down there as well?
Yeah, I was for 94, 95. 94, I started writing CD reviews, and 95, I was a music editor down there. So, you know, arranging interviews with bands and that sort of stuff, and going and chatting. And my favourite interviews was Don McGlashan in the bottom of Sammy's. That's really quite cool. And he was, there are some people who are memorable in good ways, and Don's just a good human. And you can tell good humans, you can tell people who aren't good humans. And that's, it's nice to actually find the ones who are. But yeah, so music editing critic was fun. Lots and lots of gigs, not much hearing protection, stupidity. When you're in your early mid-20s, you think you're invulnerable. Invulnerable? Bulletproof. You don't realize until much later on when people keep going, what? you keep asking for what they're saying. Do you realize you've done some damage? But it's, music, I've always liked the campus down there. I hate the current drinking culture down there. It started, it was getting worse when I was there, to the couch burnings and stuff, and it's getting worse again now.
Do you think that it's the cultural shift is kind of indicative as well of things like the shutting down of a lot of music venues in Dunedin, which has gradually happened over the years? There's not as many places for people to be able to kind of hang out or do anything other than just going out and getting on the lash. For example, when I was going through uni, I used to tour down in Dunedin quite regularly, loved Dunedin. I thought it was probably one of the best locations to play, and always enjoyed doing sets down there, especially in Port Chalmers as well. What is it? Chicks Hotel, which was a fantastic venue. Right.
Yep. Yeah,
absolute pain in the ass to get out to, and even more of a pain in the ass to get back from, especially after you've had a couple of beers and you're like, oh, okay, so I can either wait here till the morning or somehow get a bus back. However you figure it out. But do you think that's kind of like a bit of the reason why the kind of culture has shifted a lot more to, I guess, the kind of jerrier side of things, of just people just getting hammered and not really doing anything else?
I think a lot of it has to do with the middle class thing of education. The more fees have gone up, the more entitled little rich brats are coming down from Auckland who've never been told no in their life. They bring down mummy or daddy's BMW. That's BMW would have been, 10 years ago. Now it'll be, I remember seeing an Audi when I was last year thinking, oh, good God. And seeing, late model SUVs and stuff. It's like this may sound like it's coming from jealousy of financial freedom, and it's not. It really isn't. It's just when someone's never been told no, never been parented well, they have a culture of entitlement. They think they can go and do what they bloody well like, and no one's going to, and they're untouchable. And these arrogant little shits that go down there and trash the place, I find it abhorrent. It means, it means that people who might have had better grades or good grades might not ever get to university because it's cost prohibitive. Why go into university and end up with, hundreds of thousands of dollars of loan if you didn't go to the right school in the first place, so you won't get the right job in your home city, if that makes sense. And it's an elitist culture, I think. It means that it's become a cesspit, and it's become untidy. I noticed it getting untidier and untidier as I was there. More and more litter in the streets, and just, I don't think it's just me getting old.
Building off that, do you think media in New Zealand has become slightly elitist, or media in general as a vehicle for a lot of people has become more elitist? Because a lot of people at some point go through universities or colleges in order to study journalism or film or television or radio. Do you feel now it has almost become too expensive for people from varying backgrounds to study? Or do you think it's still one of the few sort of industries where anyone from any background can still be involved in it?
I think that's starting to bite it, the elitism and the money talks, BS walks sort of stuff. It's definitely part of it, I think. And I've noticed, and newsrooms managing their budgets will take a young person straight out of tech who they can mold into their own style instead of an older person who's had experience. It's been evident in my searches for media roles up here since I've been here in 2022. It's very much a case of you can have the experience, which is cool, but if you're going to demand X amount to be paid and little new grad who can come straight out and look bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and you can mould them into your little, into your, into how you want them to be, they're going to get a job with that experience and they'll work for 2 years and they'll go get a job in Cobbs. It's the turnover of journalists is huge. It's really noticeable. The career journalist is becoming scarce. It's becoming very, very scarce because comms offers so much more. And if you're working shift work journalism, the hours will suck. You're working crime scenes, that's always chipped away at your soul. You end up with a better sense, as good a sense of gallows humour as a police have, and they need it as you make jokes that would offend most people. Right-thinking people who haven't had to face trauma and haven't had to go and report things like a child being killed in the back of a car in a car accident. Once you do those sort of things, it's a stain on your soul. And you either stay in the game for a while and you can get weathered, or you go, actually, this really sucks. I'm going to go work for Heinz Whitey or Coca-Cola or something like that. Work for McDonald's Corporate Affairs. A lot of people, I think, these days are doing what I see the youngins are doing, is communications papers instead of journalism. And so they skip the middleman of working in the newsroom and cutting your teeth for a few years and going straight into comms because that's where the money is, corporate spin. And the fact that universities have all their own content creators these days, and so many people have content creators. It's because newsrooms are smaller and smaller with fewer and fewer journalists. So if a newsroom gets presented this package, we've got the CEO on camera here. He's nice background, clear audio. We'll put some cutaways in here if you want. You get the whole video package. You get a press release and it's all pretty. It's separate stripped out audio as well. Put a good staff reporter on it. Bada bing, bada boom. Done. No balance. No critiquing. No, back down to being one-dimensional journalism. It's my old chief reporter, the guy who really, Dave Cannon, who was chief reporter at the ODT while I was dog's body there. So I worked, him and I worked, side by side for 4.5 years. And it's, I ran into him, I went down to get to lead and played a show late last year. And he came along and had a chat and stuff. We're talking music and stuff. He's musical as well. He'd walk in the office singing, and I could tell after he'd sung for a bit, walking in the office, he was calmer. I said, "Bro, write some songs." I said, "You've got a great voice." He said, "I play a guitar at home, but don't do much." And now he's going to folk nights and singing, and he's a much happier guy. We're talking music after the show, and I said, "Oh, what do you think of the current news situation?" And his face just darkened. he said, "It's not good for my blood pressure to talk about that." Because it's the same thing. It's journalism 101. It's sad. We're newsrooms are understaffed. Actually getting news stories across the line that aren't just press kit A staff reporter. It's harder and harder.
Do you think that's also a thing that a lot of journalists now have to kind of come to terms with? As you mentioned, a lot of the younger ones are skipping the stepping stones and going through the newsroom, just going straight to PR. Do you feel like that is going to become more and more the norm, or people are just going to look for the side hustle, or journalism being a side hustle because of the fact that, much like what you said, it just causes you to have high blood pressure, be stressed out, and maybe at the end of the day be a little bit depressed because of maybe the stories that you're covering all the time. Do you feel that may eventually be the case, that journalism takes a sidestep and a lot of people just look at other careers instead?
Yep, absolutely. That's what it seems to be happening, happening already, and I think it's going to get worse and worse. And I'm interested to see just how, clipping rights sharing is quite cool. You have, you see stories in the Star credit RNZ. And I know Alan Press have done that as well. And you know, then and vice versa. RNZ will credit the ODT or staff or whatever. That's cool. That's nice that we're all working together on the same, you know, every agencies are working with some sort of cohesion. But there may come a time. Well, the newsrooms are already stretched, so there's not a lot of time for investigative at all. I think investigative journalism is dying. If it's not actually really dead, that's very much dying. John Campbell doing the look into the Destiny's Church, that's quite cool. Having John there as a long form journalist is nice. That's a little. It's a very small ray of hope. Consumer affairs things like Fair Go going. You know, what's next? Country Calendar. These are iconic New Zealand shows, and it's I know people, a couple of people work on Calendar, and it's and they're worried because you can see that that the money, the more it becomes like a nice to have, the highly vulnerable it becomes, and it's and I think newsrooms will shrink even more, and so there'll be more sponsored content or just provided content. And so it's more the corporations or whatever it is saying what they want you to hear. And it's, with less balance.
I think you hit the nail on the head as well with local programming. I was speaking with Carly Flynn the other day about the show Target, which at the time was a huge hit for a lot of people, but became too budget constrained by the fact that the network didn't want to keep it going because they didn't see it as being worthwhile or a moneymaker. Yet it was a beloved show, as you said, like Country Calendar, which I can't imagine a world where Country Calendar doesn't exist. I think the world's going to end if Country Calendar finally has its final episode. It would be strange, so strange for that to happen. And Do you think specialist projects, like much like what you said, like the long form content that John Campbell's doing, you feel that's naturally going to be the direction it's going? Like, you've seen new media. Well, we're talking on a podcast right now. Do you feel that is eventually going to be what journalism is? Long form podcasts or long form audio projects, video projects, which are sort of like micro documentaries or micro series. Do you think that's naturally where things are going to shift rather than having dedicated journalists who work day in, day out?
Yeah, I reckon the idea of daily news will continue to die, sadly. And I think because we can produce podcasts for little or no money. And if you get sponsorship and getting clicks and stuff, that's kind of cool. You might get income out of it. Wicked. But it's costly because it's budget constraints, and it is. It's programs like Target was legendary. It was it's really important human content, but we're going further and further away from human content. And that's, I remember the first time I saw a story about an AI journalist. I was like, I had a job interview the other day, half of it was conducted on AI. It started off with a chatbot. Here's the psycho evaluation questions. If you get past that part, you win the next golden ticket. That's the chatbot ask you questions, you do video answers. Next stage, face to face. The robots are taking over, I tell you. Terminator is real.
It's funny, because that was always the running joke for a lot of people. The tinfoil people wearing their hats. And I could definitely echo that as well, Daryl, because I had to apply for jobs recently and I had exactly the same thing. It was like, record your video answers. You have two chances to record it. And if you mess up the second one, then that's it. And it was like, oh, cool. So my life literally depends on the fact that I can answer this question in 30 seconds and not bugger up my take. Okay, cool. Yeah, it's an odd world we live in for that matter. The final question being, Daryl, because you've dipped out of the media space, the entertainment space, and now you're working the regular job, I guess you could say. I know you're working in dangerous goods, but would you ever go back? Or a better question, if the opportunity arises, is it still going to be the thing that keeps on calling you and you're like, you know what, I'll go back in for another hoon?
Always. It's like to quote Johnny Cash, like a fiend with his dope and a drunkard with his wine, a man will have lust for the lure of a mine. So for me, it's not mining, it's journalism. I'm always, like I said at the start, I grew up around it. I was playing with my toy cars in the editor's office as a kid, seeing the clouds of smoke come out of the Gisborne Herald's, you know, reporter's room, pipe smoke. I think I'll always be a storyteller, whether it's in journalism or through songs. It's just, I like, very arrogant enough to think I've got a take on them.
If you like the podcast, I'd love for you to leave a 5-star review on your preferred podcast platform and let me know your thoughts on the show. Don't forget, you can reach out to me via Instagram at BeyondBroadcastPod or via email at BeyondBroadcastPod@gmail.com. Until next time, take it easy.